O most merciful God, from whom comes all counsel, wisdom, and understanding, we humbly ask you to guide and assist us in our deliberations and in our work. May all our efforts be directed to the welfare and good of our community and our country. May we act honorably in pursuit of true justice for all our people, now and for the future, and for generations still to come. Amen.
Meeting of Parliament, Thursday, 29th of May 2014. 1. Oath of Allegiance. 2. Confirmation of minutes. The minutes of the last meeting of Parliament, which was held on the 20th and 21st of March 2014.
May I find the minutes is correct?
Communications from the Chair.
I recognize this morning our Martin, Mr. Megan Farrell, once again, and I thank him for standing in for Mr. Paul Martinez, who is away in Cardiff on CPA business.
Four petitions, five announcements.
This is my journey in welcoming back Mr. Farrell to this cameo appearance. Mr. Speaker, I'm delighted to be able to announce and to share with all members the excellent news reaching me from colleagues at the CPA conference that Gibraltar has been able to secure the 47th regional conference of the British Isles and Mediterranean region of the CPA. It will take place in Gibraltar in the spring of 2017.
And papers to be laid, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
We should have the honour to lay on the table the Air Traffic Survey Report 2013.
Order to lie.
The Honourable Minister for Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
Speaker, I have the honour to lay on the table the Annual Report of the Parole Board 2013.
Order to lie.
The Honourable Mr. Speaker.
I have the honour to report that in accordance with the Standing Order Clause 3, the Ombudsman Annual Report for the year ended the 31st of December 2013 has been submitted to Parliament, and I now rule that it has been laid on the table.
Seven reports of committees, 8 answers to all questions. Question 347 of 2014, the Honourable D.J. Bofina.
Because I'm the Minister of Full Tourism, advise where the sand which is being deposited at Sandy Bay is being imported from.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, the sand is being imported from Morocco. Mr. Speaker, I'm conscious that there's another specific question in the order paper directed at the Minister for Health. I'm told by the Minister for Health, in fact, there are two, and I think he's absolutely correct, but there are two questions actually as a result of the report that we've been receiving on the opposition side as to insect bites, which we understand being caused by spiders which were imported in the sand. As I said, these are unconfirmed reports. Can the government, or the particular minister I'm asking the question to, able to address this in his answer this morning?
Mr. Speaker, as the honourable gentleman just noted, whilst my honourable friend, the doctor, confesses no clearly sounds clear, there are two questions on that particular matter on the order paper. Well, I know the answer perhaps it would be appropriate for the honourable doctor confess to answer at that point. But if Mr. Speaker wishes the honourable minister for health and environment to answer now the particular question, we will in hand.
If you wish to call that particular question, you can do so.
I have two questions, I believe. One from the Honourable Mr. Neto and one from the Honourable Mr. Lohan.
Could you identify the question number, please? The Honourable S. M. Figueres on behalf of the Honourable J. J. Neto.
Is the Minister for Health and the Environment satisfied that the sand recently imported from Morocco and used in an attempt to return it to candidates in place for users?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir. The Department of the Environment is happy that the sand being used for Sandy Bay is safe for use. The Department officials regularly assess the sand and have not come across anything untoward.
Question 367. The Honourable Mrs. Ian Hammond.
Can the Minister for Health update the staff on the treatment and recovery of two patients who were allegedly bitten by invertebrates, supposedly found in sand at Sandy Bay a few weeks ago, who needed hospital treatment, and if bitten, whether the bites were identified with a particular invertebrate and which type?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the records show no such information specific to Sandy Bay. That the seven incidents of biting stings by invertebrates have presented at the accident and emergency department at St. Bernard Hospital since the 1st of January this year. This is perfectly normal. So I repeat that I said no such information specific to Sandy Bay is found in our office.
Well, he means it's perfectly normal, Mr. Speaker. I assume he means specifically it's nothing attributed to the alarm. Is that the case?
Yes, indeed. It's not alarming that we should have that number of bites and stings, particularly in the spring. That's quite uneventful. It's eventful if you get a nasty sting from a wasp, but it's not statistically worrying.
Speaker, a wider question in relation to the same subject, and I think it's probably more appropriate for the Minister for Health, with your indulgence, Mr. Speaker, that he should answer. Is there any standard procedure which is being carried out by the government in terms of checking the standard that's being imported from outside this jurisdiction in terms of safety and other issues like that?
Speaker, yes, the sand, when the appropriate department identifies, they will inspect samples, they will make sure that it is screened. And as I said in my answer, departments of the environment officials regularly go onto the beach and check that there is nothing untoward. There is nothing untoward. I believe that the original comment that I read about this was somebody saying in a jovial fashion, I think, oh, it's come from the Sahara. I imagine if they brought scorpions, and I think in the normal Chinese whispers, which is typical of some of the social media, it suddenly became people were actually in hospital. And then scorpions became spiders. So I've looked at it. In fact, I've looked at the record myself, and there was no indication that there's anything untoward happening there.
Mr. Speaker, this is a question for the Minister for Tourism. Are you able to tell the House what the cost of that implication currently amounts to? Is that information which he has available to him and is willing to provide the House? I don't know what the measurement would be. Would it be by the cubic meter or any other relevant measurement?
Mr. Speaker, I can actually tell him the price, including the supply, the delivery, and the spreading of the sand on the beach, which amounts to £1,490,500. That includes supply, the delivery, and the spreading of the sand on the beach.
Well, in other words, just to be absolutely clear, all told, that will be the price tag once we have a fully repaired sandy day. Is that correct?
That's this information that has been provided to me and speaking by the relevant department that coming out to supply as well, that contracted for the supply and delivery and spreading of the sand. So that is my information.
Who's actually carrying out the importation? Is it a Gibraltar company? Is it a company from outside Gibraltar? Can you give that information? But I do appreciate that it may not necessarily directly arise from the question on the auditor.
Mr. Speaker, unless I am not recalling correctly, I believe that I would ask about the award of the contract in the previous session in Parliament when I answered that the Sandy Bay contract for the relation of the beach was awarded following a public tender concluded in March of 2014. The tender document specifies the technical specifications for the sand, and following a review of the tenders received, the contract was awarded by Vanoil on the basis of the estimated most economically advantageous and compliant bid. So it's been conducted by Vanoil.
Because is Vanoil the company which is, I don't know exactly how these things work. Is Vanoil the company which is doing the importation, or is it then subcontract another company run by the importation? So does it have that information? In fact, it probably does arise from the question in the order paper, but if he doesn't have the answer in his house, maybe he can answer again next month, he can provide this information.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I do not have exactly the answer as to whether Vanoil has imported and subcontracted another company to spread the sand on the beach. But I can tell him that the contract was awarded to Vanoil. Whether Vanoil has then subcontracted to another company to spread the sand, I do not have the answer. It's either right to me, I will give him the answer, or he can ask me at an expense I'll be able to give him the information next.
Speaker, I assume he doesn't have the answer to the question that's actually posed. It wasn't necessarily to do with spreading the sand, but after the importation of the sand. So does it have an answer to that question, which is one I posed in his question?
Speaking from the information that I have before me, quite certain that it would have to be done old, and basically the tender was awarded to the particular company.
Question. Question 348, the Honourable D.J. Bacino.
Can the Minister for Tourism advise whether any airlines operating from Gibraltar are receiving any subsidy or concessions from the government or any government-owned company?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, this question is very similar to the question that the Honourable Gentleman asked me, namely question number 826 of 2012. As I informed him at the time,
All commercial discussions are commercial in confidence as part of the government's continuing drive to increase air connectivity. I am happy to advise the Honourable Gentleman, however, that the government continues to operate the incentives and discount scheme implemented in 2010, and that the GTB discusses marketing collaborations with its airline partners. As I advise the Honourable Gentleman in the question that I just mentioned, I will not be drawn to publicly announce across the floor of the House whether any airline enjoys an incentive scheme, subsidy or concession from government, as to do so would undermine any negotiation advantage of the Manchester government of Gibraltar in those discussions.
Question 349, the Honourable DJ Buckingham.
And the Minister for the Port states what measures, if any, the government has taken in connection with the Spanish actions relating to bunkering services being conducted in Gibraltar.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, in the first place, I do not accept the premise of the question. As far as the Majesty's Government of Gibraltar is aware, there have been no Spanish actions relating to bunkering services in Gibraltar. Bunkering services continue in Gibraltar as they have always done. Notwithstanding, and irrespective of any reports from the Spanish media, the Gibraltar Port Authority and I have agreed a series of measures to stimulate all economic areas of port activity. These new policies will be announced during the course of the budget debate.
Mr. Speaker, I welcome the answer that he's given. Obviously, I base myself on what I hear in the press. I'm not privy to any other information. And certainly on the basis of very press releases that one reads, there is certainly a threat of action. Now he says that and I quote, he says that no Spanish actions have been taken. Haven't there been incidents of filming by Spanish authorities of our bunkering operators in Gibraltar territorial waters? Is he able to confirm or deny that?
Mr. Speaker, if I may be helpful to the Honourable Gentleman, the question asks the measures that the government has taken in connection with Spanish actions relating to bunkering. I can tell you quite confidently that the Spanish authorities have not taken any actions in relation to bunkering, and I am sure that the House will be delighted to know that bunkering operations in Gibraltar continue as peacefully as they have always done. There have been instances where foreign vessels have taken pictures, not just of certain operations in the port, but also in relation to the drawings on Sunday day. But that does not mean that any actions have been taken in relation to that project either, simply that we are aware of reports of photographs or filming of things like
that. Mr. Speaker, there was a report in the Telegraph, I think it was, albeit back in August when we were suffering from the brunt of the trouble, where it was reported that apparently Spain had actually approved legislation. I haven't checked that myself. Actually approved legislation banning permanently anchored fuel storage tankers from operating in its protected waters and included, in their view, the disputed waters around the rock in the framework of the legislation. Wouldn't the Minister consider that would be a specific Spanish action which ought to be addressed by the government in terms of the need for the immediate and long-term future economic viability of this particular activity?
Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Gentleman will know, the position of the Manchester government, and I dare say every position, the government's position clearly is that no legislative action could possibly in any way affect the legal jurisdiction, powers, controls, sovereignty, and jurisdiction of British sovereignty in Gibraltar waters. So, I suppose we are concerned the Spanish government may legislate at their level, at their will, but certainly it would not in any way impact on port operations or indeed any other sphere of life in Gibraltar.
In my first reply, the Honourable Gentleman said banking activities continue as they have always done, and then in the second he said banking activities continue as fruitfully as they have always done.
Can the Minister confirm that he has not noticed any statistical downturn in bunkering activities in the port of Gibraltar?
Mr. Speaker, unfortunately, the downturn started on the Royal Ministry in 2009. The people in last year and this year have been a very negative decrease.
Yes, sir. Question 350, the Honourable S.N. Together.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Transport provide an update on the replacement of the bus route?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, government is currently in the award stage of the tender for the replacement of the bus route.
Mr. Speaker, I recall in the House, either the last or one before, where we last dealt with this matter, that this is related to the technology that's going to be used in the buses. I was wondering whether perhaps the Minister would be able to confirm whether doubts in that regard have now been resolved, and what the time frame for delivery of the buses, or rather for award of the contract in the first place and then delivery of the buses, is.
Mr. Speaker, let me tell the House that I will advise the gentleman what I understand the process to be, because this is dealt with by the procurement office. As I understand it, once the government has decided on the award of the contract, a letter must be sent to the successful company and the unsuccessful company. I am then advised that there follows a mandatory Alcatel period, known because of the Alcatel case. And it is a standing period, which is a 10 calendar day period, following notification, whereby the unsuccessful tenderer has the chance to submit notice to why they thought that the tender should have been awarded to them. So until then, there will not be a national allocation. We are currently at the standstill or appetite period. 10 days. Yeah.
I'm grateful to the Minister for the clarification in that respect. If he is notwithstanding that answer, in a position to say once the contract is agreed with the successful tender, when the buses can be expected to begin to be delivered?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman will remember that the last time he asked me questions on the subject matter, I told him that there were two companies that had proceeded to the final stage. So there are two companies. Those two companies will obviously know when they have told us that they will be able to deliver those buses. If I were to give the Honourable Gentleman the time frame, they will know we've been successful and not. So I cannot at this stage say these.
I think, Mr. Speaker, I have understood his previous answer to mean that both successful and unsuccessful tenders would have already been notified. In any event,
sorry, as I told the Honourable Gentleman, I could tell him what the process was, but because it's dealt with by the procurement office, I cannot tell him whether anything will go out. It's not done by me.
So, being at this stage of the process, Mr. Speaker, it's not unreasonable to expect that at the next session there should be some more certainty in that regard.
Absolutely, Mr. Speaker.
Question 361, the Honourable S.N. Pierre.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Transport say whether the Peter Salamania matter has now concluded?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman knows that the hearing of the claim has concluded and a decision from the Industrial Tribunal is awaited.
Just to recollect where we were. But usually it's the judgment. Exclusively in relation to
quantum. I think that was a delusion. Because as I understood it, but my memory is somewhat hazy in this one, because sometimes things I vote with it. But I think that in relation to the substantive liability issue, there had been a concession by the government. And if you recall, as the minister will recall, Mr. Speaker, that was a subject of much debate and time spent in relation to that matter in this house. As I recall, all that is pending at this stage is a decision by the chairman of the Investment Trade Union in relation to quantum.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman would be right in saying that there has been a push for the House. I would say sufficient discussion on this matter in fact in respect of this particular question, the question 237 of 2012, where we go into 8 pages of transfer, where we discuss whether the judgment is in respect of anything other than quantum or just quantum, and asking on this side of the House the matter of prejudice, where the judgment handed down is in the hand of government. I repeat that in less than 7 pages, the Honourable Gentleman, given that the matter is pending as a judicial decision, I will limit myself to just making that comment.
Question 252, the Honourable S.M. Pierre.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, can the Minister of Transport say whether there has been any substantial progress in the Jibby Bikes matter?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Tourism, Commercial Affairs, Public Transport and the Port.
Mr. Speaker, my answer remains the same as the answer to question number 106 of 2014. The Magistrate Government of Gibraltar has entered into litigation with a contractor and will make a public announcement on the conclusion of the legal proceedings, including any appeal by either party.
Next question. Question 353 is going to be answered by the Minister of Advance on behalf of Minister Linares, who will be taken later on today. And question 354 to 359 will be answered by the Chief Minister on behalf of Minister Linares. This will be done this afternoon. Question 360, the Honourable Minister Esteban Figueres on behalf of Minister Mr.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for the Environment please say if there has been any variation to any of the companies providing services to the Ministry of the Environment in contract in 2012, and if so, provide full details to Parliament?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, it is not up to the government to assess variation of the company. As long as the contract is adhered to, which is the main concern of the Department of the Environment.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I look to the Honourable Minister's reply to the question. I suspect that it is being taken on the meaning of the language of the question, which I again suspect has been adopted perhaps in a unfortunate manner, given that the question is certainly to me, and I am asking it on behalf of my honourable friend, Mr. Neville, that the question was intended to elucidate information about variations to the contracts themselves rather than the companies. I'll grant that in the language of the question itself, the Honourable Minister may not have noticed. But if the Minister is in a position to provide any details in relation to any variations that he's aware of, I'd be very grateful, but again, think that he may not have appropriate notice in this instance.
Mr. Speaker, I think I would inevitably give an incomplete answer. As the question was phrased, it seems that it was asking for a variation in the composition of the company, which is the answer that I have given. If it's the only change in the company or in the contract, I have knowledge of some, but it would be an incomplete answer, and I would hesitate. What I can say is that those companies that have had contracts still valid and enforced in 2011, in December 2011, still retain those contracts. There are some contracts which have expired and were being run either by the same companies or in some other way out of contract, and we are in the process of regularizing that. But I would not like to give any more details because I am likely to get something wrong, and I would rather have notice of a question for a future meeting.
Next question. Question number 361. The Honourable President Segura on behalf of the Senator.
Question 361, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Maloof-Cannon. Question 361, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Maloof-Cannon on behalf of the Honourable J.J.
Mr. Speaker, prior to written question number 137 of 2014, can the Minister for the Environment state which recommendations of the fishing report have been implemented in the last 12 months, which ones will be implemented over the next 12 months, and which recommendations the government feels it will not be able to implement and why?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
I apologise, I have assumed that Mr. Figueroa is continuing with Mr. Nettle's question. That's absolutely fine. Mr. Speaker, in addition to the recommendations implemented already, as highlighted in my response to written question 137 of 213, the following measures have also been implemented, which are relevant to some of the recommendations made in the fishing report. One, employment of environmental protection officers within the Department of the Environment who will be assisting in the implementation of the upcoming marine protection regulation. Two, review of the artificial reef program within the southern waters of Gibraltar. Three, implementation of a tagging initiative in conjunction with local fishing clubs for sea bream species. The intention is to extend this initiative to migratory species found in the Strait of Gibraltar, such as bluefin tuna. Implementation of all the recommendations is continually under consideration.
Question 362, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Maloof-Cannon, on behalf of the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Question number 55 of 2014. Has the government now awarded the tender for the sewage treatment plant? And if so, please provide details of the work to be carried, location, the company that has been awarded the contract, the timeline for operations to start, and the cost associated with the work to be carried out.
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the tender for sewage treatment has still not been awarded. It is currently in the assessment stage.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister say when the award, the submission deadline for this particular tender expires?
No, Mr. Speaker. I'm involved in this matter peripherally. The main minister would be my colleague, the Minister for Utilities, who is not here. I don't have that information.
Is the Minister able to say whether the delivery of the sewage treatment plant will be complete by the end of this term of office?
Mr. Speaker, there is a possibility. If the tender were awarded quickly, then that would be a possibility.
Question 364, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Lloyd Hammond, on behalf of the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for the Environment say how many individuals have been fined or cautioned for the illegal enticing or feeding of macaques, contrary to the recent changes in legislation passed in Parliament, either inside or outside the Upper Rock Nature Reserve, stating where, nationality, the amounts imposed, which entity imposed the fine, and whether some cases are waiting to be heard in court?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, one individual of some nationality was cautioned by the Royal Gibraltar Police for the illegal feeding of macaques outside the nature reserve. I will add that it was in the area of Sandibay.
Next question 365, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Lloyd Hammond, on behalf of the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for the Environment say if he is now in a position to provide Parliament with a copy of the Upper Rock Management Plan?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the Gibraltar Nature Management Plan is still being drafted and will be published as soon as possible after a period of consultation.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister will concede that the plan has been being prepared for some time now. Is there any definitive timeline that he has in that he or his department has in mind for the conclusion of the plan and publication thereof?
I think I would have liked it to have been ready by now. It is a complex piece of work. Already some of the aspects of the recommendations that will be in the plan are being carried out routinely, like improvements in the habitat management and other improvements that we have seen in the Upper Rock. Remember that the Upper Rock, although it's one of my ministerial responsibilities, that I work very closely with my colleague, the Honourable Minister for Tourism in this, and we are aware of a lot of improvements that form part of this. So I'm hoping that it will be completed relatively soon. Certainly, we're talking about a couple of months. I wouldn't have thought it would be much more than that. And believe me, Mr. Speaker, it would be well worth the wait.
Mr. Speaker, I wonder whether perhaps the Minister, who so very kindly offers information in relation to those aspects of the plan which have already been implemented and are being implemented continually, as he's referred to on a number of occasions today and on previous occasions. It strikes me, Mr. Speaker, that there must be certain types of plans which are either more controversial or simply more complicated and are therefore not just being concluded. And while that is understandable, I wonder whether the Honourable Minister would be so kind as to give the House a flavour of the issues that remain the source of such controversy and therefore make the publication of the plan something that has not yet happened.
No, Mr. Speaker, because it's my intention to resolve the controversy, and then the Honourable Member opposite will be having nothing to worry about.
Question 366, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Lloyd Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health show whether he has received any application under the Smoke Free Environment Act 2012 in order to declare a zone excluded from such act?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir.
Question 368, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna Mills-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health say when the abdominal aortic aneurysm screening programme will start?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, work is progressing steadily and we hope to be able to launch the programme towards the end of this year.
Question 369, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna Mills-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health say when the cancer registry will be made available for public access?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the cancer registry is a research database that is available as a data source to answer general questions of public health value that may be put to. Currently, the data are available for the period 1999 to 2009, and further years will be added as and when the data are validated and cleaned. It was never intended that the cancer registry would be made available for public access. Cancer registry data are held on persons, many of whom are alive, and are subject to prevention of disclosure for several legal and ethical reasons, including data protection, confidentiality, and privacy. While the raw data will not be publicly disclosed, questions of public health value may be put to the GHA, and if such questions will benefit from the analysis of the cancer registry data, the data will be used. Any results returned will be subject to the restriction that disclosure or identification of individuals directly or indirectly is not permitted.
Mr. Speaker, what about making available just the numbers, getting rid of the personal data, but the numbers of cancers per year and type of cancer?
Mr. Speaker, is it possible to do that in a way that it is totally, that we can ensure total confidentiality, and then that is not a problem. The problem is that a community the size of Gibraltar and with the family links and friendship ties that we have, it is often possible, particularly in the rarer conditions, to identify individuals. But if it is possible to do this, and we can be absolutely certain that individuals will not be identified, these data are not secret.
Question 370, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna Mills-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health advise that all the GPs and nurse practitioners at the primary care centre prescribe the morning after pill and if not, how many opt out? And why? I'll read the question again. Can the Minister for Health advise that all the GPs and nurse practitioners at the primary care centre prescribe the morning after pill and if not, how many opt out and why?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Speaker, all GPs and nurse practitioners may prescribe the morning after pill if they feel it is clinically appropriate. Prescribers may refuse to supply on grounds of religious or ethical objection as per the professional code of ethics. There are physicians that refuse to prescribe on ethical or religious grounds. But those that do object will refer the patient to another GHA prescriber, therefore not negating the patient's rejection if deemed clinically appropriate. The Speaker, once again, because we have a relatively small number of practitioners and there's a relatively small number of those who do not prescribe it, and in order to protect the confidentiality, I'm not going to reveal the numbers across this house, but I'm happy to advise the member opposite behind the speaker's chair.
Question 371, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna Mills-Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health explain what the GHA's primary care family planning services are at present, and how far the 7 public health department initiatives announced by the Minister in answer to question number 818 of 2013 have progressed?
answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the Component of Family Planning Service forms part of the Well Woman Clinic, which offers prescriptions and advice on contraception and other related subjects. Prior to the reply given to question 818 of 2013, the Public Health Department has progressed initiatives within this program as follows. 1. Supporting education about sex and relationships in schools and youth settings. The Health Promotion Officer has met with the Child Health Team on several occasions to discuss sexual health promotion in schools. A meeting has been arranged with the Education Department to review the PSHC curriculum on sexual health and support the education where necessary. 2. Providing access to good quality advice for all persons on sexuality, family planning, and sexually transmitted diseases. People can receive a sexual health check from infection control nurses, nurse practitioners, or general practitioners. Persons needing family planning and other sexual health advice would also have the same option. 3. Continuing to reduce the prevalence of teenage pregnancies in our community. Dr. Rafale visits the Girls' Comprehensive School to present an awareness talk every year. There is no similar service for the boys' school. This is being addressed. A sexual health awareness day for the general public is under consideration. The department is also considering the production of information on the subject of teenage pregnancy. 4. Supporting the establishment of a nurse-led sexual health clinic. The nurse practitioners are interested in developing a nurse-led sexual health clinic, and this requires further planning, which is in place. 5. Encouraging access to HIV and STD testing for people who may be at risk. The infection control nurses provide a drop-in service for people to come and be tested, which is usually through referrals from GPs, other health professionals, or word of mouth. Sexually transmitted disease still carries a stigma, and some people are reluctant to get tested in the water for fear of disclosure in a small community, and many patients prefer to get tested in Spain or UK. GPs and nurse practitioners also provide HIV testing. 6. Improving the collection of anonymized medical data to inform sexual health strategies. Counts of sexually transmitted diseases, according to organism detected, are obtained from the St. Bernard Hospital Laboratory every month on an anonymized basis. From 2013, anonymized records are also being kept of people using the drop-in facilities for sexual health screening. 7. Producing relevant printed materials. The department has procured a number of leaflets on sexual health issues from the UK, and these are distributed within the primary care centre. It has a stock of separate leaflets for boys and for girls, which are distributed to schools. The department is in the process of developing local leaflets.
Mr. Speaker, how is the group Equality Rights helping and advising for the expansion of the GHA's family planning services?
Mr. Speaker, meetings have been held with the group, both with myself, with the infection control nurses, and with the health promotion officer, and we are going to be meeting again shortly in order to see how we can support each other's work in this respect.
What work is this specifically? How are they involved? What are the qualifications of the group in order to advise and support a family planning service?
Mr. Speaker, the question of what are the qualifications in any group who involves itself in promoting health is a question that can be asked widely. Community groups often have people with no formal qualification, but with a great deal of interest and experience, and the government works together with all of them, as many of them as want to work with the government, in developing ideas and planning strategies. What the government will ensure is that any clinical or professional work is carried out under the guidance of its own qualified and trained personnel. But certainly we are open to discussions and to be informed by the experiences and by the interests of all community groups, including the Equality Rights Group.
And Mr. Speaker, will the Gibraltar Women's Association also be consulted and involved in part of this process?
Mr. Speaker, the Gibraltar Women's Association is already involved in the process. I've held meetings with them, and we have raised the subject. In fact, the question of the fact that there wasn't a service to the boys' school as well as there is to the girls' school came up during a meeting with the Committee of the Women's Association, and that matter, as I have said in my notes, has been taken up. So clearly, any group that has an interest in developing this sort of initiative is more than welcome, and my office is open, not just to them, but to a lot of people in the community, know virtually to anybody, well, to anybody who wants to see me about any of these things.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to the fourth initiative to be led by Public Health Department supporting the establishment of a nurse-led sexual health clinic, could the Minister give a little bit more information about this? Would the nurses be taking over the role from the Well Woman Clinic and the GP?
Too early in the day to have an indication, but certainly the role of the nurse practitioners and GPs in this sort of initiative would always be paramount. There are a number of nurse-led initiatives which are very successful in the primary care centre, the dermatology initiative being one which has very recently been in the news, both for the success of the nurse leadership, Linda Castro, in getting an award in the UK, and also the initiative of a walk-in cancer screening, which was carried out for the first time a few weeks ago. And that is a nurse-led clinic that involves GPs and involves visiting consultants. So there need be no fear that a nurse-led clinic is going to be diluted in any way. On the contrary, this in many ways is the future for healthcare, and the professionalism, dedication, and expertise of nurses is something that we cannot understate.
Question 372, the Honourable Mrs. Ironman Lou Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health advise who the jury to a doctor's eye that can refer patients for the privately provided natural technology treatment as an alternative to IVF treatment?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, access to this technology is currently under discussion.
Mr. Speaker, is the Honourable Minister saying that at the moment there is no access to this treatment, or there has been access up until now and it's been stopped and being reviewed?
Mr. Speaker, what I'm saying is that the use of this technology is currently under discussion with the entity that is offering to provide it, but that does not mean that if there were any patient who it was felt was indicated to have this technology, that this could not be dealt with in advance of an agreement being reached with the provider. This happens in a lot of situations. What I'm saying is that there is no formal arrangement at the moment, and nor have I detected a demand for it either.
Mr. Speaker, I was under the impression that this service was on offer via the GHA. Can he explain why it's under discussion? Is this because of lack of evidence?
Mr. Speaker, the GHA will provide services. Some of these services are under contract. For example, IVF is under contract following its tender process. Other services are dealt with on an ad hoc basis. There may be things that we don't regularly do at the moment. As I said before, this is a clinical indicator that would be made available, but we still do not have a service level agreement or a contract with the provider, and we are discussing that at the moment.
Question 373, the Honourable Mrs. Ian and Lord Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, as per the government press release 173 of 2014, can the Minister for Health say when the 24-hour manning of the LME inspection will start and how that will improve the patient experience of LME?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, the LME reception staff will be recruited shortly, which will allow a point of contact for patients through the night and at weekends, and will also mean that these duties do not have to be carried out by nurses, hence allowing the more time to attend to patients.
Question 374, the Honourable Mrs. Ian and Lord Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, as per government press release 173 of 2014, can the Minister for Health say how the primary care centre will be redesigned and what extra services will be offered in the extra clinic space?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Speaker, the alterations which have been carried out at present in the PCC have been aimed primarily at offering more clinic space to the professionals working within it and also to create the possibility of improving services. The alterations have consisted of redesigned better space to provide conditions for administrative staff, four clinics and waiting area which can be used by both GPs and nursing staff, one unit which will be used to consolidate all the various professionals working in dermatology into one cohesive unit, a new smaller boardroom, a part of the exercise storage units are being created away from the main clinical areas, the long-term aim being to convert stores in existence in these main areas into more clinical space. These alterations will immediately provide a better clinical environment for service users and staff alike. It will create enough clinics to allow professionals the ability to arrange clinics more efficiently. It will avoid incidences of double booking of clinics as can happen. It will create infrastructure necessary for expansion of services and reinforces the creation of the dermatology unit as a service.
Question 375, the Honourable Mrs. Ian and Lord Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, as per the government press release 173 of 2014, can the Minister for Health say what the further improvements to the repeat prescription system will be?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
Mr. Speaker, further information has been published and disseminated to service users and stakeholders to assist with informing patients of the current procedures in place to obtain chronic repeatable medication. In addition, we are currently in the final stages prior to launching a repeat prescription pilot scheme, which we anticipate will provide benefits regarding medicine management.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister give us a little more information about the pilot scheme?
Speaker, I can give a little bit more information, but I'm not leading on this. It will allow the possibility in certain situations where the doctor doesn't need to see the patient for the prescription being provided without the patient needing to see the doctor. And we're working out how, whether that could be done manually or whether it can be done electronically, and that is where we are at the moment.
Mr. Speaker, that is very welcome. Can the Honourable Minister say who is leading on this?
The team at the primary care centre, which will involve the GPs and prescribers and the health centre administration.
Mr. Speaker, and can the Honourable Minister say when the pilot scheme will be launched?
No, Mr. Speaker, I would have to ask the people involved. I'm told that they're very close to it, but I don't have a starting point.
Question 376, the Honourable Mrs. Ironman Lord Hammond.
Mrs. Cooper, can the Minister for Health tell me what the plan for chronic disease management care is at the primary care centre?
I'll say the Honourable Minister for Health and the Environment.
The Speaker, chronic disease management represents a substantial percentage of the current GP workload. Some general practitioners also incorporate areas of special interest, such as diabetes, dermatology, and urology. The medical element is further supported by the multidisciplinary teams of specialist nurses and allied health professionals who work in partnership with patients and relatives through a process of case management, regular reviews and evaluation, providing patients with support, information and education in health management, and lifestyle changes. Evidence-based guidelines and protocols provide the standards for optimal care. The list you know, which I'm about to read, highlights some of the services currently providing chronic disease management. Diabetes service, case management and annual reviews, DAPNI programs for type 1 diabetes, and Desmond self-management programs for ongoing and newly diagnosed diabetes. Cardiac rehabilitation, new patient and self-help programs. Hypertension, wholesome monitoring and nurse-led assessment review clinics. Mental welfare officers, case management of GP referred patients. Respiratory, nurse-led for primary care, offering spirometry, management of COPD, COAD, pediatric adult asthma clinics, nursing cessation service. Dermatology, nurse-led light therapy and case management and review of chronic skin conditions. Chronic ulcers and corresponding lymphedema management, nurse-led case management and review.
Mr. Speaker, is there a chronic disease register?
Mr. Speaker, a chronic disease register as such is a title I am not aware of, but certainly we do have data on chronic disease, as all these clinics will have their own database. As for a chronic disease register labeled as such, I would need notice of the question to see in what form such information is kept.
Mr. Speaker, would the Honourable Minister be able to say if there is a system in place to manage each chronic disease patient annually to ensure that they receive monitoring and treatment, prescription monitoring, and so on? There is for each different chronic disease.
Mr. Speaker, it depends on the disease. I'm not aware of all the information. I can say, for example, that the diabetes service, which is very, very effectively run, we are shortly going to be introducing an annual review by a consultant for type 1, which is something that is done in the UK and other countries and has never been done in Gibraltar before. Certainly for hypertension, the GPs normally want to see a patient every 6 months or every 12 months. I would have to, for that specific detail as to the frequency in which each patient is seen in each of these chronic disease management protocols, I would need notice in order to be able to give factual details of every single case.
And again, Mr. Speaker, is the Minister aware of any incentivization or how GPs are encouraged to manage chronic disease and are perhaps more time consuming or difficult patients?
Mr. Speaker, again, that is pretty specific. I would have thought that our GPs would be, well, I know for a fact that they are dedicated and responsible enough to manage their patients in whichever way the clinical condition requires. So I am confident that this is happening.
I And finally, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister mentioned the new system that's going to be put in place for type 1 diabetes, where patients will be seen or reviewed by a consultant annually. Will this system be introduced, or is it being considered for other chronic disease management, annual reviews with a consultant locally?
It depends on the condition. And there are some conditions which do not require a consultant to carry out an annual review. Conditions in which a GP perhaps with specialist interest and knowledge of a particular condition, or nurse practitioner can deal with the routine, and they would only be referred to a consultant for when it's particularly indicated. It so happens that for type 1 diabetes, it is recommended, it is part of NICE guidelines in the UK, and this is a program that we are about to introduce. Using our existing consultants.
Question 377, the Honourable Mrs. Alan Lee-Holland.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health explain what the arrangements, the terms and conditions are in the new contract the GHA has with the private hospital of Zanet to provide healthcare services for GHA patients, and provide a copy of such contract to this House?
And to the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, Zanet Hospital is used by the GHA as a tertiary referral centre. The authority refers patients to Zanet in the same way that it refers patients to other centres in the UK and Spain. The nature of the referral depends on the judgment of the referring clinician or the preference of the patient. The authority entered into a contractual arrangement with Zanet last year, which in the main catered for the pattern of referrals that had been in existence over a number of years, during which the patients were referred without a formal contract being in place. As a result of the formalized arrangement, the authority was able to obtain a reduction in cost for most of these services. For example, we have been able to lock down the prices of certain procedures regardless of how long the patient requires admission at the hospital. A number of specialties and procedures have since been added to the list on the recommendation of clinicians. The government does not consider that it is appropriate to disclose details of the commercial arrangement that the DHA has entered into with Zanet Hospital.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Minister say, do we pay then a monthly fixed rate, or is it based on the number of patients we send to Zanet? Is it based on the treatment type or the length of time that GHA patients use the services?
Mr. Speaker, there is no fixed rate. We pay for the services provided according to a schedule of prices that are agreed and fixed. And as I say, Mr. Speaker, when I took over the role of Minister for Health and Chairmanship of the GHA, patients would be referred on an ad hoc basis, and the bills would come in without any fixed price. The contract has set a set fee, agreed and comparable to fees in other hospitals, and in some circumstances, has actually, as I said before, locked the prices for certain procedures, which means that you cannot always know how long a person has to be in hospital. In the contract, we have been able to arrange that for certain procedures, no matter how long the patient stays, the price is the same. And therefore, we have obtained, I believe, a reduction in the cost per procedure and also certain guarantees. And we pay as we use the service.
Mr. Speaker, if I ask the Honourable Minister for the cost over the last financial year for the use of Zanet and the list of the fixed prices, I know he may not have that information with him today. If I write to him or ask him next month, will he be able to provide me with that information?
Mr. Speaker, I believe that the Honourable Member has asked me the valid question. In fact, the other member has asked me a host of written questions. I'm obviously very popular. I think I get more questions than anybody else. And I have no, I don't know, nobody says that I do a lot. But some of the questions ask for some details down to a breakdown of cost in the DHA per month per department, which makes me wonder why on earth these questions are asked, because I cannot see no benefit in the opposition knowing how many bandages there are, how much money spent on bandages in a month in any particular department. And it's a serious concern for me, Mr. Speaker, because there are public servants who are spending a lot of time answering questions, and by all means, the opposition has every right to ask questions. The questions, I think, that will be a benefit to them in their contribution to a better developer. But asking such kind of details which takes public servants many hours and many days to answer for no apparent effect in the end, to me, that time would be better spent in doing other things. But anyway, that is just an opinion, and I take the opportunity. I'm not forgetting what the honourable member is asking, so she'd better ask him again.
Mr. Speaker, he's asked the question that I've asked her to ask, the first part of the question, which I can't possibly characterise in the way that the honourable gentleman has characterised it, which is how much he's been paid to Zanis over the last financial year. Do you have a perfectly entitled to that information?
Oh, absolutely, Mr. Speaker, and that information has been given in the written answer that the general member is going to get. What I'm alluding to is other questions like how much to leave over 3 days per grade for the whole the monthly figures of cost per department, monthly cost per hospital, per condition in the UK. These are things that, I mean, monthly figures really have not much value, because if you don't get all the bills 1 month, you might get it the next month, and therefore these things are not relevant. I think an overview of a year, comparing year with year, that's fine. But getting down to the nitty-gritty of these details, asking, for example, on the question of security, in which you have a human resources department spending 3 or 4 days there, not being able to ask to break his vacancy, and then I get a question as to why I got so many vacancies. To speak, I think the opposition has to really take stock of how they are asking questions, or the number of questions they are asking, and of the negative effect they can have on the public service for no benefit for the voters, Mr. Speaker. But on the personal examiner, that information will be given on an annual basis.
Mr. Speaker, obviously he wasn't a member of the opposition at the time, and we were answering a battery of statistical questions on a regular basis. But look, we will be the judge, as a magistrate of the position of Gibraltar, what is relevant, what is not relevant, what is good for Gibraltar, what is not good for Gibraltar. His role is to answer questions. But Mr. Speaker, the honourable gentleman said that in relation to Zanis, originally there had been an ad hoc arrangement which has now been consolidated into an overall agreement. Now, I note that in the past there have been referrals to, for example, other institutions, such as the very well-known Excellence Institute in Navarra, the Pamplona Institute, Cancer Research and Treatment Institute, and I wonder whether the government is also thinking of conducting that same exercise in relation to that interest.
Mr. Speaker, he may be the judge, but I think his judgment is flawed. And certainly, I have never had the experience of being in opposition. I hope I never will. But certainly, I doubt whether questions like how many package chicks have been born on the upper up, which I've got again as a written question this time around, when I have explained that it's impossible to tell to normal
This question of the sort of information which the opposition is of the government is nothing new. It is something that has been happening over the years. There is only one member here apart from myself, and that is the Honourable Mr. Fosano, who will recall when during the budget session in committee, a particular member of the opposition persisted in asking for every single item of overtime in all the budget for the public works department. And the UC spent a week, a
a week in committee during the budget. Now that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen any longer. No, it wasn't Mr. Bolsonaro. No, it wasn't. Mr. Bolsonaro took a much broader view of matters. It wasn't Mr. Bolsonaro. All he succeeded in doing was in tying down the ministers of the government for a whole week here. So that is nothing new, and I'm sure that all members, when they are in government, feel that an excessive amount of time is perhaps being devoted in having to provide answers to questions, but it has both ways.
And I apologize that I don't want to mention the subject. I have no problem at all in the. I'm going to complain in a minute. I have no problem at all in supporting the public servants when they do this work. But I do question whether there's any pain in some of the questions that are asked. But anyway, that's another. Pamplona, let's go to Pamplona. Mr. Speaker, we do refer patients to the University of Navarra facilities in Pamplona, and we are currently under discussion with them looking at possibilities of forming up the relationship in a very efficient way. So we are in discussion and we'll see what comes of it.
Mr. Speaker, if I may just end with one final supplementary, going back to the information on Janet, what I've now requested and will be requesting is a schedule of the fixed prices for the different teams.
I have no problem in giving that to the member offices. I would ask it to keep those confidential because obviously if we are discussing with other hospitals, then we are not just in Pamplona, we are open to discuss with other hospitals. That would be commercially sensitive.
Question 278, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Lloyd-Cummings.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health say what role, if any, the Spanish private hospital Janet has played in the negotiation and establishment of a new joint management structure or in the consultant contract?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, this is probably one of the most bizarre questions I have had to answer because I just can't see. Anyway, Mr. Speaker, none, sir.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister confirm that no GOK meetings or negotiations for new GOK services have taken place at Janet?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, now I see. Mr. Speaker, one meeting was held there because one aspect that was explained. No, this is. This is mischievous. This is mischievous and totally unjustified. The question clearly says, what role has the Spanish private hospital played in the negotiation? That is, no, really, Mr. Speaker, the meeting was held in Dallas because one of the members of the negotiating team was a patient in Dallas, and in order to allow the negotiations to not be delayed, the meeting was held there. Mr. Speaker, I think the members of the meeting should think about that they're asking for a little bit more information because they're not available.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister confirm whether or not the acting Chief Executive, who is now consultant, Mr. John Lannan, has been operating out of Zenit as part of a unit for the establishment of the new GOK management structure, or has he held meetings on behalf of the GOK?
Mr. Speaker, repeat. One of the members of the team, and I will not mention the name here, was a patient there, long-term patient, and therefore in order not to delay the negotiations, a meeting was held there so that he could attend. That is it. Absolutely no relationship at all to Zanz as an organization other than the use of the room.
Question 279, the Honourable Mrs. Ian Lloyd-Cummings.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Health explain how GHO staff are screened for transmissible bloodborne viruses and what the vaccination program is?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, staff members are tested for exposure to transmissible bloodborne viruses in the event of a needle stick injury. There is also a program to screen all existing GSA staff for hepatitis B immunity and offer them vaccination if hepatitis against hepatitis B is indicated. This is part of a wider program for the public service, which was long overdue and which the government is proud to have introduced.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I understand that the hepatitis B vaccination program for emergency and public service staff of the GHA was introduced. It was reported in the media. So, what about screening, getting screening for all new entrants into the GHA, to the emergency services, the screening program for hepatitis B and other viruses such as HIV and hepatitis C and so on, where there's an order automatically screened before starting work within an emergency setting or a health environment?
Mr. Speaker, this has never been carried out in Gibraltar. I would need the advice of the Director of Public Health if you thought that was indicated.
Question 380, the Honourable S. Angelou.
Mr. Speaker, can the government say whether any concerns have been raised by residents of neighbouring estates in relation to the construction of the Charleston Farm House?
Answer. The Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, we'll answer the question today with questions 381 to 386.
Question 381.
Can the government say whether it was taking steps to ensure that any heavy machinery required in the construction of Charleston Farm House will be operated in a manner that does not put the children and staff at undue risk of injury?
Question 382.
Can the government say what procedures are in place for access by emergency services vehicles to government metal and district sterile schools during the continued closure of Europe Avenue and the building of Charleston Farm House?
Question 383.
Can the government say what steps it has taken to ensure that children, staff and students at the three schools in the vicinity of the Charleston Farm House construction site have adequate exit and defending locations in the case of emergencies?
Question 384.
Can the government say to what extent, if any, the facilities adjacent to the site of Charleston Farm House will be affected by the construction of the new building?
Question 385.
Can the government say whether any concerns about the safety of the staff and children at Governor Federal House have been raised with the government since the announcement of Charleston Farm House by members of staff from any of the schools in the area?
Question 386.
And Mr. Speaker, is the government satisfied that the children at Governor's Meadow School are safe from hazards arising from the construction of Charleston Farm House?
Answer. The Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the government has not received any representations from residents of neighbouring estates in relation to the construction of Charleston Farm House. Representations have, however, been received from a group of parents whose children go to Governor's Meadow and Bishop Terrace schools. The Department of Education, through the Director of Education, have also raised a number of issues to be taken into account during the construction of Charleston Farm House. Meetings have been held between the government's project team and the contractors management team and health and safety advisors with the Director of Education and the head teachers of the three schools in the area to discuss all issues and explain how these will be addressed. A meeting has also been held with the representatives of the concerned parents to similarly address their concerns and explain how they will be addressed. The full reopening of Europort Avenue to traffic on the 23rd of May 2014 meant that access for emergency services to the Governor's Meadow and Bishop's Meadow schools will be the same as it always previously been. The housing project site is self-contained within that within what used to be the car park, so there should not be any effect on the access arrangements for emergency services while construction of the building is ongoing. The issue of emergency exits and assembly points have been discussed and reviewed by the City Fire Brigade Fire Safety Officer together with the heads of the three schools. Revisions have been made to the school's emergency plans to reflect changes made to exit routes and assembly points all of which are in place. The sports pitches located on the southern west of Westside School will not be affected while Charlestown House is being built, other than for the stadium, which will be erected along the boundary wall. This will only encroach 1.5 metres into the school area and will not prevent the pitches from being used for the same purposes as they currently are. Responsibility for health and safety on site lies with the main contractor in accordance with current laws and regulations. As this is the case for all building sites, the government's health and safety inspector will carry out inspections and take action against the contractor should there be any breaches or unsafe practices. The contractor's mandatory health and safety plan includes for all heavy machinery to be operated within the constraints of the site, including the transportation of heavy loads.
Mr. Speaker, I'm grateful to the Honourable Minister for the comprehensive answer he has given to a few of the questions I have asked him. I would be grateful if you could just confirm, because I heard in the answer, but I mean it was substantial, and I know him myself, that the Norfolk Avenue has reopened on the 23rd of May. Also, in relation to the site where the building was being constructed, I understood from representations that were made to me that was indeed the assembly site for an emergency scenario for the school. Can I confirm that the minister has actually said that those arrangements have been reviewed and different processes are now in place in that respect?
Given the arrangements concerning the school, that I would be relieved for the supplementary. It is indeed correct that all those matters, including health and safety issues and evacuation procedures and emergency procedures, have been fully reviewed. The site in question was an area where people would congregate in the event of an emergency, and certainly other sites have been identified, including areas of physical sales, and as you know, very much also to the Westside School, and that has also been identified. In case there is a need to have a full evacuation of both the government level and Bayside School area, everybody will congregate on the Westside area. So alternative arrangements certainly have been made, and that will certainly be taken into account.
Great. Well, Mr. Speaker, one of the representations that was made to me that exits from the area of the two schools into what is effectively Montague Garden area, that there were certain issues relating to that, including the access to the area. Is this something that has been considered by the government and actually the appropriators?
Speaker, it is something that has been considered by the government, and it is something that has been dealt with appropriately. There has now been an agreement with Montague Garden Estate for the opening of another exit from Westside into Westside Estate, Montague Garden Estate directly. That is in the course of being done. And although the question says that all emergency exits and revised arrangements are in place, this is an additional item over and above all the other arrangements that are in place in order to have, in the event of an emergency, whether there is a need to evacuate through Westside and on outside of Westside School into Montague Gardens area. So that is certainly something that has been considered and has been now fully agreed and will be implemented very recently.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just two short supplementary questions just on this issue. Now, in relation to the use of the heavy machinery and in particular the trains on site, representations received by myself from concerned parents suggested and the fact that some video footage, in fact, of heavy machinery operating in a manner that represented to the layman unnecessary, an undue risk an undue risk to people in the area. And I suppose that the second supplementary, the last supplementary, is what can be asked in conjunction with that, and that is whether there are any concerns that have been raised with the government that remain outstanding or that have not been dealt with to the satisfaction of those who have raised it with them to the government's side, too.
speak that in relation to Ukraine, we're advised that it is perfectly normal in any society to have a claim where the jig, the front part of the claim, goes over adjoining areas. Unless you have a large enough site and you have the claim in the middle, generally a claim will encroach over the adjoining areas, in other words, the jig, the front part. And in this particular case, that there will be some what is called pre-claiming of the jig around the adjoining area. However, what we have made absolutely sure is that there will be absolutely no lifting and no goods will be transferred in that part of the claim which will go beyond the area of the site itself. That is an absolute restriction that has been placed on the contractors, and the contractors will have confirmed to us. They didn't need to confirm it, and that this is all part of health and safety regulations that we have to do in any event. But it is, in fact, a strict restriction in relation to the construction site, and the contractors have clearly confirmed that this is a restriction which will be very, very strictly adhered to. The Honourable Member also asked about other concerns and other issues which have been raised, issues that have been raised, concern, noise, dust, vibration, traffic. All those issues have been adequately addressed in a comprehensive plan which has been put together by the contractor. There have been numerous meetings between the Department of Education, Technical Services Department, and the contractor. I attended a site meeting myself with both the contractors, representatives, and members of my honourable friends of the Rwandan Department of Technical Services Department, in which we looked at all these issues. A comprehensive plan has been put together, and all the issues have been addressed, certainly to the government's satisfaction. With regard to the parents, there was recently a meeting attended by the Deputy Chief Minister, hosted by the Deputy Chief Minister, with a group of concerned parents and the Director of Education and members of Technical Services Department were also there. I understand, and the Deputy Chief Minister can further enlighten us if necessary, that all those issues were addressed and explanations were given, and satisfactory explanations were given to the group of concerned parents who appeared to be the meeting satisfied with whether they're entirely satisfied or not. It's not for me to say, but certainly those issues have been addressed, meetings have taken place, and they appear to be satisfied with the explanation that we're getting to them.
Question 387, the Honourable F. M. Figueroa.
Mr. Speaker, can the government provide details of the possible collapse of Liverpool Avenue in March this year?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, during maintenance work, it is discovered that there was a partial collapse of the main drainage system on Liverpool Avenue at two places way across the road. At said location, there was an old storm water culvert and the seawater intake, which were constructed using corrugated iron sheets surrounded in concrete. Over the years, and given the lack of maintenance, the corrugated iron sheets corroded and left their structural integrity, leading to loss of materials into the culvert. The works carried out have involved the complete replacement of the existing system from the entrance of the school up to the corner of Clifton Court, using new plastic pipes. Works are currently progressing on the reconstruction of a manhole on the Clifton Court side and the laying of the last short section of pipe. The final items of work shall be the partial reconstruction of the existing manhole in front of the school and repairs to the inlet culvert. These works will be undertaken during the school summer break.
Question 388, the Honourable Senator.
Mr. Speaker, I suspect that we've already covered this once, but I'll ask the question in any event and just ask any other questions that are mentioned accordingly. Can the Minister for Traffic say when he expects the Liverpool Avenue to reopen to traffic?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, Liverpool Avenue was reopened to traffic on Friday, 23rd of May, 2014.
Mr. Speaker, in the context of his answer to question 387, and that there are certain parts of the work yet to be completed, there's any need for traffic arrangements between limits flow through there, or there is, I mean, I've not been in the area since I asked the question. As the Honourable Minister is suggesting, I've not been in the area, I don't know what arrangements are in place, if any. Is the Honourable Minister of Traffic able to provide us with details of what arrangements, if any, are in place for management of traffic during the time that the remaining works are conducted?
I believe that no more work will be done on that road, to say. I think the work will be done within Kaila, within Station Court. Within Station Court, as far as I know, as I believe.
Question 389, the Honourable S. M. Bezerra.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Traffic detail the work currently ongoing in Dudley Woodbury Tunnel?
I'll say the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
The work currently ongoing in Dudley Woodbury Tunnel comprises the following: A. The provision of rapid water, wet main and fire hydrants at intervals along the tunnel. B. The provision of fixed emergency telephone call points at intervals along the tunnel. C. The provision of fire extinguishers at intervals along the tunnel. And D. The removal of redundant exposed pipes and supports. The works are programmed to be completed by the end of August 2014.
Question 390, the Honourable F.M. Bezerra.
Can the Minister for Traffic detail the costs relating to the widening of the Europa Road and the additional stations along various stretches of it, as well as confirm when these work stages are expected to be completed?
I'll say the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the sections of new pavements that are constructed along the southern end of the Europa Road have been built as part of the new water mains infrastructure project being undertaken by Aquagrid. The new mains were being encased, so the opportunity was taken to upgrade this for pavement. Technical Services Department have supplied the paving slabs and railings along this section. The section of new pavement between the end of the Aquagrid work and the start of the section of new pavement being constructed as part of the Buenavista development project has been taken by the Technical Services Department. The total cost of this, including the paving slab and railings to the southern section, is £28,459.60. The works for the pavements undertaken by Aquagrid and Technical Services have been completed.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I take the opportunity to commend the government on their initiative. Definitely, it's one that's welcome on the side of the House and by many residents in the area. I wonder whether the Minister is able to tell us whether he has any notice of this question, but generally arises in the context of it, whether there are any plans for the development of pavements along the northern section of the road, particularly in the area of between Brinton and the access to Sunset Coast.
No, I haven't. I'm not receiving a question. I wouldn't be able to answer correctly. I mean, the issues there, I would assume, are the actual size road itself, because it's been a very narrow road. I mean, the road that's been repaired in question was one which many residents in the area, you know, were concerned about, especially roads which the cars do travel at reasonable speed, and there was no protection for pedestrians, and hence the government took this available opportunity by making these payments, which is possible, but there is an area that, you know, clearly by the past Brinton, which, you know, I would assume that it wouldn't be possible to build a payment along the whole length of that road. Mr. Speaker, I've actually given the issue some sort from a personal point of view, because I used to live at Highcliff House. In fact, I also raised it with the former Minister for Trade and Industry, Mr. Joe Holliday, and he said that in fact it may well be possible, because part of the, I can't remember which part, but part of the land, either the wall on the left-hand side as you walk south, or on the right-hand side, the parts of that are actually owned by the government of Gibraltar, so it may well be possible to keep the width of the road as it is, but build a pavement in areas that are owned by the government. In any event, actually, If you were to ask the residents there whether they would be amenable to losing a meter in front of their drive, just to have a pavement that actually works to their advantage, it is possible that they would also agree. But my question is, would the minister perhaps look into this? Because it is one of the most dangerous parts of the border. There are a lot of people that walk their dogs, a lot of people that walk with their children in that particular area, and it is very, very dangerous. Speaker, we will most certainly agree that it's something which should be looked at, and we will most certainly be looking at an adjustment within the next 16 years of government.
In relation to the congratulations on your confidence, in relation to that area, the Honourable Minister has been talking about the stretch from Brimpton to the bottom of Windmill Hill. Has the government considered having a partial one-way system with the road that takes you partly down Naval Hospital Hill and then up out via Brimpton, and then that stretch of road, of Europa Road, from Brimpton to the bottom of Windmill Hill? Perhaps considering a one-way system there, and that would enable to provide room for a pavement.
I don't believe that has been considered, but as part of traffic time, we will be looking at every single aspect that could help. I mean, remember, one of our priorities is to increase the safety of pedestrians and try to go to another place. But if something it can be done, we'd look at it. But I don't believe that the government has looked at that, but I will ask the department.
Question 391, the Honourable S.M. Pereira.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Traffic detail what plans the government has for the large-scale refurbishing of Gibraltar Bridge?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the contract to carry out the first phase of a major highway refurbishing programme has recently been awarded to AMCO Gibraltar Limited in the sum of £577,231.75. The work will involve the full resurfacing of Langwell Road from Smith Road and Bridge up to Perth Ram, and the full resurfacing of Rose Road from the Trafalgar Interchange up to its northern junction with Cumberland Road.
I'm sorry, could you ask the Minister to repeat the last bit from Trafalgar Interchange to?
The work will involve the full resurfacing of Angle Road from Smith Road and Bridge up to Coast Ramp, and the full resurfacing of Rose Road from the Trafalgar Interchange up to its northern junction with Cumberland Road.
For the reply. I wonder whether he could repeat the cost. I didn't quite get the answer.
Mr. Speaker, the cost was £577,231.75.
Mr. Speaker, this question does generally arise from the original one in terms of the actual deployment of the resurfacing. Has the contractor encountered any issues with the cycling of
the equipment that they are using to prepare for this resurfacing, mainly on the east side of Clarington.
I will allow you supplementary, but I find it very difficult to see what connection you have with the original question, but I will allow it.
And Mr. Speaker, this is an issue which is being dealt with generally also in my office, because it involves all different parts of Gibraltar. And you, as I can see, the honourable backbencher looking at me, he'll know that this is part of the jigsaw puzzle that is to do. There have been no issues because the plant that is there is simply there at the moment, not to operate. It's only there while an area in a different part of the reclamation is made available, which was probably taken up by rock and sand, which has been used for the Sandy Bay project, that will move into an area where there will be no issues of the operation of the plant. Great question, Minister. Could the Honourable Minister for Traffic say whether, in addition to the contract that's been awarded in the Central Railway Road and Ranger Road, whether there are any other plans in the pipeline for the surfacing in other areas of Gibraltar?
Mr. Speaker, we were looking at the next phase in the program would be the southern section of Langwell Road and Queensway. Question 392, the Honourable S. M. Figueroa.
Mr. Speaker, can we traffic provide an update to this panel in the context of the findings of a sustainable traffic and transport management plan?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, we answer the question together with question 393 to 396.
Question 393.
Can the Minister for Traffic say when he expects the sustainable traffic and transport management plan will be published?
Question 394.
Can the Minister for Traffic provide details to the House of Initiatives which the Government is intending to pursue or is indeed pursuing as a result of the findings of the Sustainable Traffic and Transport Management Plan?
Question 395.
Can the Minister for Traffic provide details to the House of the traffic measures he expects to be carried out in consonance with the findings of the Sustainable Traffic and Transport Management Plan?
Question 396.
Can the Minister for Traffic say what the total cost of the taxpayer has so far been in the context of the Sustainable Traffic and Transport Management Plan?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, the first draft of the Government's new Sustainable Traffic Transport and Parking Plan has been completed. This is currently undergoing an internal review process, so it is not possible to give a definite date for its publication. It is not possible to provide details at this stage of the findings, the initiatives that will be pursued, nor the measures that will be implemented as these are still subject to review. As has been previously stated in this Parliament, the plan will look at ways of encouraging alternative forms of transport with the aim of improving our environment and how we move around for the benefit of all. The total cost to date in the context of the Sustainable Traffic Transport and Parking Plan is £368,219.05.
I am grateful for the answer, though I have to say that it seems that this plan is the subject of great mystery when it is something that would certainly, I think, be very welcome in the public domain, and definitely not least for the opposition. It strikes us, Mr. Speaker, that there will have been many findings that, subject to any kind of redraft or internal review that is currently ongoing, there should be no great issue with divulging and making available to the opposition in this House. What reasons can the Minister give for the delay in providing this House, at the very least, if not publication of the plan itself, providing details to this House of those issues, rather more specifically generally trying to encourage alternative forms of transport, and all those methods that we've covered here in the past. But for not doing that,
I encourage the eagerness of the member and the opposition to have, you know, to see what important findings come as part of the Strategic Plan. And you must remember, this is a draft, and it's a work in progress. I mean, those members who have read the draft, you know, can see that there will be very many positive suggestions, and it will be definitely something which would be very, very positive for Gibraltar. And so that draft has been read through, and it becomes a final document, and then that is when the opposition will be able to have it as will the whole Gibraltar will study.
Mr. Speaker, is the minute to say that the government has not made any decisions whatsoever in respect of any measures whatsoever that they will be taking following the recommendations and findings of the plan? And if they have taken such decisions, because definitely are very clear to them and the stakeholders, why is it that he cannot tell the South what it is that they are already planning on doing?
Mr. Speaker, I think it's important that we understand the parameters that we're talking about. The plan is being worked on at the moment by the local technical people who have received the draft from those who have been helping us prepare it. It hasn't yet been shared with other ministries. It will have to be shared with other ministries for other ministries to have input also. Once we have done that, then we will produce a final document, which we will be happy to know, I reiterate, will be shared with them and with all of the public in Gibraltar. Now, he would be right, Mr. Speaker, to take us to task for not publishing the final report. He would be absolutely right to say that we did not publish the final report. We would not be complying with our obligations of accountability and transparency. He would be absolutely right to say that with the final report on which we have spent taxpayers' money, we should not be acting without sharing that information with the public and with, of course, members of the community. But of course, if he did that, Mr. Speaker, he would run the risk of being a critic of the previous administration, which had many reports which they did not publish. And I hear the Honourable the Leader of the Opposition groaning. I'm not surprised, Mr. Speaker, because the strain of the record of the previous administration that he has to pull along with him, which does not enable them to rise at the phoenix that they wish to rise at, like, is there. And it's a history that is always going to bed them. I remind him, for example, Mr. Speaker, of the report into the future of GBC prepared by Mr. Alan King, something which I was asking the previous administration to disclose for many years. We entered into a commitment that we would publish the minute that we were elected, and we published it 2 weeks after we were elected. There was nothing there in our view that could not be shared with the public. We made a small redaction which identified an individual, but otherwise it was a report paid for by taxpayer and shared with the public. Of course, there's also the report into the future of the Customs Department, which is prepared by the previous administration and not shared publicly, although paid by taxpayer, which we also shared with the public and with the people at Customs who were concerned. So, Mr. Speaker, absolutely right to preface and publish in the report, but absolutely no chance of us publishing the draft. I promise I'm not lying to speak, but I would like to just give a supplementary here. The word draft has been used by both honourable members in their response. Would honourable members confirm whether they have received a report from the consultant and they are now considering it locally to produce from it the report of what they want to do, in other words, their action plan? Does the word adjective draft apply to the report or to their action plan of what parts of the report they wish to accept and not accept, which is normal. The consultants come in, they make a million recommendations, and then the government will consider them and execute the ones that they like and implement them. Have they received a report which is not in draft or a list of ideas or recommendations from the consultants? As I understand the position, what has been received is a draft. Still for consultation with the technical people here who are working with the technical people in the UK. That's why it hasn't been shared with the Cabinet as a whole yet.
I understand that one or two ministries whose technical staff is the staff involved in liaison with the technical people in the UK are the ones who have it. But there isn't yet something which is at the concrete level of a recommendation.
I'm not alluding to the publication of the reports itself in the supplementary that I asked. I'm alluding to initiatives or findings which are generally accepted as positive and workable into broadcast that may still be subject to further internal review on the details of how they will be deployed. But you know, the disclosure of those findings which have wide acceptance, which may provide a glimpse into what it is that we can expect in the future as a result of the term.
Mr. Speaker, how many things in the report that I have so far which will be very interesting to the field? And as you said, the report will be targeting other forms of transport, so other forms of moving people around the world in a more environmentally friendly way. So it will be looking at the use of more bicycles and we'll be looking at the buses, all these things we have mentioned already. And until we know, and these are recommendations, and we need to look at these in detail and before taking a final decision.
Will the Honourable Senator just put in the question 297 in respect of this meeting? 297 and 353. So the question is posed by the Honourable Member, Mr. Nettie. Question 397. The Honourable SNP goes on behalf of the Honourable J. Mitchell.
Mr. Speaker, further to question number 783 of 2013 and to the answer to written question number W149 of 2013, can the government state how many of the vehicles since these questions were asked have been bought today are powered by non-polluting engines other than the G1?
I'm Steve, the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services.
Mr. Speaker, no vehicle powered by an exclusively non-polluting engine has been bought since question number 783 of 2013 was asked.
Question 353, the Honourable SNP Rebels on behalf of the Honourable J.J. Mitchell.
Mr. Speaker, further to question number 240 of 2014 and to question number 573 of 2013, can the Minister of Report Limited Utilities please provide Parliament with copies of the four reports stated in his answer in relation to the new power station, given that according to the Honourable Minister, the allocation of the tender would be towards, and I quote, towards the end of April?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Traffic, Housing and Technical Services on behalf of the Honourable Minister for Sport, Culture, Heritage and Youth.
Mr. Speaker, the answer remains the same as that of my answer to question number 240 of 2014.
Question 398. The Honourable D.J. Bassino.
Can the Minister for Financial Services provide details of the trips he has undertaken since coming into office, together with the costs of such attendance broken down by travel costs, sufficient allowance, and who attended with him?
Answer the Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Just to give you information, the question is available on the government website.
Question 399. This is a question which has been posed by the Honourable J.J. Mitchell, and it's in connection with the specialist and the education department. He is going to be question 399, the Honourable Mrs. Ayanna Rowe Hammond, on behalf of the Honourable J. J. Nathan.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister for Education say if there have been recent reports of asbestos concerns in Bishop's Girls' School, and if so, provide Parliament with a statement?
I answer the Honourable Minister of Education, Telecommunications and Justice.
Mr. Speaker, no recent reports in relation to concerns over the steps of the Bishop of Surrey have been brought to the attention of the Department of Education.
We are now going to proceed to questions which have been put to Minister Vapani. Question 400, the Honourable D.J. Messina.
Can the Minister for Employment provide details of how many people are undergoing training at the cost of the government, together with the industry area in which such training is being carried out, outside the SJS school?
Answer, the Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
I will answer a question together with questions 401 to 406, not 405. So.
Question 401.
Can the Minister for Employment provide updated details of the expenditure in terms of salaries paid to the trainees in the SJS since it replied to question number 325 of 2014, broken down on a monthly basis?
Question 402.
Can the Minister for Employment provide current details as to how many employees each of Construction Training Company Limited, ECCL, Graduate Research Development Company Limited, and SECL have had, broken down by month since his answer to question number 328 of 2014 today?
Question 403.
Can the Minister for Employment provide updated details of the number of private employers which have employed SJS trainees, with details of how many trainees have been employed by each employer, broken down by month since his answer to question 329 of 2014 today?
Question 404.
Can the Minister for Employment state where trainees are currently placed in the private sector as relevant to the industry area of the private employers?
Question 405.
Can the Minister for Employment provide details as to where the grad trainees are currently placed?
Answer. The Honourable Minister for Enterprise, Training, Employment and Health and Safety.
The speaker, there are currently 10 persons in such training in the industry area for school transport and related services and in joint transport. Salaries paid to trainees in the answer to question 325 are as follows: February £400,000, March £406,000, April £370,000. Since the answer to question 328, the number of employees are as follows: Company 1, January to April. January 134, February 145, March 121, April 118. Company 2, January 155, February 151, March 151, April 115. Company 3, January 80, February 72, March 70, April 67. Company 4, January 73, February 72, March 72, April 70. Since the answer to question 329, the number of trainees and the number of private employers are as follows: February 43 employers with one employee each, 15 with two trainees each, 10 with three, 10 with 4, 2 with 5, 2 with 6, 1 with 7, 1 with 12. Mark 49 with 1 each, 25 with 2 each, 10 with 3, 5 with 4 each, 2 with 5 each, 1 with 6, 1 with 7, 1 with 11. April 53 employers, 1 trainee each, 20 with 2 each, 13 with 3 each, 3 with 4 each, 2 with 5, and 2 with 6. The industry report of the private sector training placement as of the 31st of March 2014 was as follows. Other manufacturing, construction, wholesale trade, retail trade, repairs of consumer goods, restaurants, bars, etc., sea transport and related services, road transport, banking, finance and insurance, police and fire service, education, and other services. On the 30th of April, the grad trainees were placed in the following industry areas: public administration and national defense, and other services.
A question of detail. I can't cite the exact. Which question the honourable member minister was answering, but I think it's basically the number of training. I have a specific question related to that, and perhaps you can clarify. But it's basically the list you gave of employees who have trainees employed. Or have employed trainees rather. And I think he gave me the details for January, February, and then he went on to April. Has he given me March? He has given me.
The figure for January was given the last time we had to continue.
And in relation to that question, which I think is, I can identify question 403, the question specifically relates to the number of private employers who have actually employed trainees. While with the benefit of time, I read the answer he gave me in the last sitting of the House in March. He provides the statistical information. But based on this is the way he says his example, which is the number of private employers with 20 employees between them and who get set by the date. Just to be certain that we are both going from the same hints and we understand each other. What I'm asking is the number of employees that actually formally employ trainees as opposed to having trainees close to them. Can you confirm that he's understood the way that I have put the question?
The answer that I gave to 329 and the answer that I have given is the number of trainees still paid by the scheme and placed with the employer. So there are 43 that have got one each as a trainee. The bulk of this will, of course, be employed, and I can give them a list of when the training is finished. But I mean, these are the people who are currently in training. This is a distribution of where the trainees are placed.
Yeah, I think, in fact, there's been a misunderstanding. The question was very specifically worded. But then I was able to, again, with the benefit of time, when I had the chance to review the answer he gave in writing, I noticed that I think he misunderstood the question. Perhaps I'm repeating myself, but the answer, this is also interesting information which I will analyze, but what I'm interested in is the statistics which show the trainees have actually been formally employed by the private employers. In other words, the trainees are no longer, like in the terminology or the way that one of the ministers answered the question right now, no longer in the payroll of the speaker, and actually in the payroll of the prize and prayer. That's the information that I thought in Mark, and I'm seeking upgrading information I'm seeking now. Obviously, it's information which I'm sure you'll remember can provide, but presumably will not be able to provide this morning.
Well, I can provide it, but of course, it's not very meaningful in the sense that these are the people that are currently in the training. We already know from the figures that when you ask me how many of the trainees have finished up in employment at the end of the training, and the answer that I gave him when he asked me after the last time, which was quite a long time ago, was that it was 65% at that time. So, in effect, the percentage, if anything, is higher now than it was then, but it is not, the magic of no particular relevance. I mean, in the case of only one person with 43 employers, the people start in different periods and finish in different periods. There is no correlation between the month in which they spend in training and the month in which they finish in training. But I can tell him that it is of the order of 65 to 70% of the numbers that I've got here to finish unemployed.
The question that he's asked is a very specific question. He said, details of the number of private employers which have been employed, which have employed teachers of private trainees. Now, we all know that the employment contracts of the trainees are not with the private companies. They are with ETCL and the other companies. They are the ones that employ these individuals. They are the ones that pay them. He's asking for how many private employers have employed teachers of private trainees. Because he specifically given another answer. He's asking now for us to extrapolate the figures from the percentage that he's giving us. Now, if he doesn't have the statistics, I accept that, even though the question is very specific and it's very clear, but will he provide, in answer, will he provide to my friend by way of a letter, the monthly statistics, because that is what he's asking. How many people have actually been employed by employers following their training in January, in February, in March, and in April?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm answering it the same way as I'm answering that question 329, because the question is the answer to question 329. So I'm giving an answer which follows the same as the one that we asked previously, which was in fact understood to mean what was the distribution of trainee employees. When they completed their training, they're no longer trainees, of course, they're then employees of the placement provider. And I've already told him that the last time I answered that question was 55%, and that the percentage is higher, and of course I can go and get the department to work out the figures. And if he asks me the question the next time, I will give it to him for both 329 and this one, if he wants it for 329 as well.
Can I suggest that the Honourable Christopher follows the matter up in writing and makes it clear in his letter to the Minister exactly what is the information that he wants? Mr. Speaker, the question is in fact in very clear terms, and it's exactly the same terms as I've told you here. But clearly understood from meeting the answer of the Honourable Minister, I have the answer here. Fair enough. We're all human, we all make mistakes. But just for the record, the question was, is and was in very, very clear terms. Question four. Well, Speaker, there were five, six questions bunched together, and I have some supplementary. I did not make an accurate note of the answer of the Honourable Member gave in relation to question 400, which was posed in terms of the assistance which the government has given outside the FJS team. The reason why I asked that question is that I think the Honourable Member, if you recall, that the last sitting of the House said that assistance was being given to those individuals who, for example, wanted to undergo heavy goods vehicle training, or I think he also cited the example against the memory of hairdressing. but they weren't formally part of the SAS team. In other words, they don't necessarily have to subject themselves to a contract in a department with a private employer. They can follow that team. And I was interested to know what the cost of that was. I'm not sure if I got the answer, because I haven't taken a full note of that particular the answer you were given to that particular question. The question is question 400.
Bigger, question 400 says how many people are on the road paying at a cost to the government, but it didn't pay at what cost to the government. So what I mean is the number, which is really up. And the number 10. There are 10 people. Although 6 were doing bus driving, but they don't get paid. What the government pay is the cost to the company that is paying them.
Do we have information as to the cost to the government?
It works out of about 1,200 per person for a period of 3 months or something like that. That's the overall cost. To train somebody who's already got a driving license and get him up to what is required by the public service or the transport commission or whoever it is that gives them a license to be able to drive a public service vehicle takes 3 months and costs about £100 a month per driver.
Yeah, I think the Honourable Minister said that there were about 6 of the 10 who are benefiting from this. And the others are in which area of activity?
The others are involved in maritime activities and are not paid from the vote of the ETB. They are paid from a fund that has been there for some time, which is created from a levy from the port users, but the money comes out of that fund. And there are 4 people in that area.
Yeah, can the minister tell me what how do individuals access this facility? I mean, is there somebody pops around to the ECB offices and asks for assistance? What criteria for selection of a candidate will be in place? Is there any formality in relation to in terms of selection, in terms of how much money they get paid? Because I do specifically recall him referring to various areas of activity. I don't think he was specific. He was just almost suggested that anybody who approached the government with an idea, whether it be an employer or somebody who wants to benefit from training, can approach the government and obtain assistance in this regard. Can you shed some light in relation to that?
Well, the maritime thing is not run by the employment service, and has been there for some time, and I think it's advertised and people apply, and there are 4 currently. The bus driver is, and for example, heavy goods and plant operators and stuff like that, is something that is offered to people who are unemployed in order to improve. I mean, if we find, for example, that there are bus driver vacancies and we have difficulty in filling them, or there are requirements for lorry drivers or plant operators, and we have difficulties in filling it because the people who are registered unemployed do not have the necessary skill, or may have the skill, but do not have the necessary licenses, then what the employment officers do is, when they are looking at the jobs that can be offered to the people that are being assisted in finding employment, they are told that training in these areas is available, but this is not part of the normal thing because they continue to be registered unemployed and they don't get paid while they're being trained. The only cost is the cost of the position of a trainee. So that is what is the only area. I mean, I've assumed that outside the scheme meant that they're not with a contract of employment with one or 4 companies. Right. But at the moment, it is the bus driver.
So this is something which which is in a sense that his department has a complete control and handle, and they're the ones who decide and identify that there is a deficiency in skills in one area, and as he's explained, they offer basically a way out. But is it something which is there available and transparent and available to all, so that people, is it an extra service which is available to the public in general, which can be accessed by the public in general by cutting around to the minister's office and trying to find out whether any assistance is. And I specifically, again, I've said this on the third occasion, but specifically the call that the honourable member mentioned hairdressing, for example, which doesn't fall into the category he's been referring to us this morning. So I just thought, no, is this something that is available to the public in general and that they can benefit from?
Okay. It is something that is done by the department in order to get people who are not with a job into a job. So the answer to this is not somebody coming to the office and says, well, I like the idea of being able to drive a bus. So it doesn't happen like that, clearly. You've got to be unemployed, you've got to be looking for work. You've got to be in a position to be willing to work as a bus driver. You've got to be in a position to pass whatever vetting is required of bus drivers because of the government responsibility for driving passenger vehicles. And if you meet the criteria where obtaining the license makes the difference between being able to apply for the job or not being able to apply for the job, then in effect what we're doing is, in addition to the training where we take people on a payroll, we are providing training where the unemployed person clearly cannot afford to pay for the training because he's unemployed. So it's as simple as that. It's simply a mechanism for adding something more to the range of mechanisms that the department has in order to bring unemployment down. Independent of that, the question of something like hairdressing, which I mentioned before, is different from the normal thing, because today what we've got is somebody that approaches government with a proposal for training hairdressers, but those hairdressers are being paid 20 hours a week, because unlike the bus driving thing, which is something that people can still carry on being unemployed and go and also get training 2 or 3 days a week, in the case of the hairdressers, they are 20 hours in a hairdressing salon getting trained, we are paying them 20 hours. But the trainer is not required to undertake to employ the people that are doing their hairdressing. So that is one thing that makes it different from the normal system, which is the vacancy is identified and the person that is applied as a trainee is being trained for the job that already exists. In this case, the people who are doing the hairdressing will, on completion of the hairdressing, not have a guaranteed job.
Mr. Speaker, if I might, after that exposition of the excellent work being done at the Employment Ministry, may I move that the House now adjourn until 3 p.m. this afternoon? Not adjourn, recess until 3 p.m. this afternoon.
Mr. Speaker, simply to point out that obviously I'm still in the midst of taking supplementary to the 5 questions which were bunched up together by the end of the meeting. Thank you.